This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 226 for December 10th, 2009. Listener feedback number 81. It's time for Security Now, the show that covers your privacy and security online with the guru of privacy and security, our very own Steve Gibson. Steve, it's great to see you once again from GRC.com.
Glad to be with you, Leo. We've got a Q&A episode, our 81st one, with some security news, some a little bit of errata. I have an interesting SpinRite story from the future. This has been sent back from the future, so I thought that was, you know, a fun thing to share. And we've got our Q&A.
I love that idea. Any, what do you want to start with, errata or news? News, I guess, huh?
News, yeah. This is just the podcast following the standard second Tuesday of the month. So Microsoft has, on cue, released a batch of updates. There were 11 things that they fixed. None of them are particularly notable there, so I'm not going to go into any great detail. The good news is that they did fix, as we were projecting and hoping they would, that bad zero-day vulnerability in Internet Explorer, which we discussed at length. It was either last week or the week before. And I remember saying at the time, I hoped that they would have time to fix this because it was being actively exploited on the net. There were plenty of documentation about how to do it, and people were getting hurt by it. So that was fixed. So I just wanted to mention that we had passed through another second Tuesday of the month, and to encourage people to keep themselves up to date, as always.
Do they put out, like, you can look up Patch Tuesday and what was patched for this Patch Tuesday?
Yes, they have a, page for essentially for December 09. All of them had, except one, actually, there was an ATL.com vulnerability that wasn't high exploitability. Because remember, they now associate each of these with an exploitability index, which is, you know, yes, there's a problem, and then Microsoft rates how likely they think it is to actually be exploited. It's like, okay, well, fine. So, you know, these were all, you know, definitely things you want to get patched, because Microsoft is saying, yeah, there's probably going to be exploits created from these.
Quite a few, but not a huge one like last month.
Yes, not a record-breaking one. Yeah. So that's good. There's an interesting trend that has just recently surfaced, which is really good, which is voting systems are beginning to swing open, to open source rather than closed.
Yay!
Yes, that's just such good news. There's an open source digital voting foundation, the OSDV, that has an 8-year timeline, because like a roadmap, during which they're going to produce a comprehensive, publicly owned, open source, complete electronic voting system, from registration all the way through election management and vote tallying. They've got a good team that are putting this thing together. They've released the event was that they released sort of a preliminary blob of code to say, you know, here's a sample of what we're going to be doing. And then what was really interesting was that just 5 days after that, one of the most notoriously problematic closed source companies, that is Sequoia, that's had all kinds of problems with its voting systems, they announced that they were going to go open source.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, which is really good news. And
now, why is open source? Just maybe say briefly why that's a good thing.
Well, for something like this, I don't necessarily believe that having something open source instantly means that it's going to be safer. But open source, which is actively scrutinized, is arguably dramatically safer.
At least you know what's going on.
Yeah, and that's the key. So, you know, so the fact that something is open source, if it's open and no one ever looks at it, well, it doesn't help you any. But if being open, it allows and experts do take advantage of the fact that it's open, then you're in good shape. Now, Sequoia, for example, they threatened to sue Lee Felton and his friends at Princeton if, in response to a court order where Princeton was asked to analyze these machines, if they did so, then Sequoia said, we're going to sue you.
Oh.
So, I mean...
Oh. That's exactly the opposite of open.
Yeah.
Like, don't touch our stuff.
You could argue that, like, you know, they're like the poster child of the wrong way to do this.
Hiding it.
Saying that everything is proprietary and it's all closed and just trust us. Yet when the results of their machinery have been looked at closely, there have been discrepancies found. And they've said, oh, it must have been a static discharge.
I'm sorry.
Or, no, I'm not kidding.
I get it. I'm sorry.
You know, like, vote tallies didn't tally. Oh, well, ooh, it's an operator error or a static discharge. Yes. And it's like, okay, well, how are we supposed to trust these people?
Supposed to wear wrist bracelets when you vote.
So... It's really, really good that, first of all, that there is this open source digital voting foundation. The idea will be that they'll produce an open source system because it exists and many people care. Lots of smart people will study the source and say, hey, as far as I can tell, they've done like all my hot buttons have been, like, taken care of here. Now, it's certainly the case that something can still be missed, but it's much better to have many eyeballs looking at it than not. So Sequoia doing this demonstrates another step forward. And in the case of the OSDV, this Open Source Digital Voting Foundation, they're going to freely license the result of this project to machine makers and others who have some application for it, and I'm sure the license will include some things, you know, some constraints on, look, we're giving this to you for you to use, but you can't just go screwing around with it. You know, you've got to use it as is, and if you make changes, then there'll have to be some sort of review process, blah blah blah. But, you know, the idea being that the value added will no longer be this intellectual property, which is so prone to mistakes. Instead, the value added, and there's still things that people, you know, the companies can do to add value, will be in the packaging and the production and the deployment and, you know, and all the bells and whistles, which will allow them to have product differentiation. It just won't be that there will be any value, that is, any commercial value in secret intellectual property. In fact, you could argue as more companies take this approach, those that have that are trying to maintain closed systems will then they'll end up having a hard time convincing anyone to buy their stuff.
Let's hope so. Anyway, yeah,
so
good.
Really, really a good news.
Yeah.
Now on the bad news front, for our listeners in the UK, and we know we have many, ZDNet. UK reported the news that the major ISP, Virgin Media, has announced formally that they are about to employ deep packet inspection to anonymously scan their customers' data, everything going to and from their customers, without their consent.
They're telling them that.
Well, they're telling the world. The world's not happy, as you can imagine. What they're saying is that they're wanting to assess anonymously how much illegal copyrighted file sharing is transiting their system. So they're using deep packet inspection to look at the data transactions to their customers. The top level is they check to see whether the protocol is any of the known notorious file sharing protocols. And if so, then they will go deeper into the packets and look to see whether that flow is apparently copyrighted data. Now, they're saying that all of this is done anonymously, that the equipment that's been installed and they're getting ready to turn on, it strips the IP address of the customer out of the packet. They're not attempting and intending at this point to do anything more than just get some sense for how much of this is going on. So, you know, to me, this feels like the beginning of something worse, but we'll have to see. And apparently, their public acknowledgement of this is not the sort of thing that they think is really going to be great PR for them, but they must have felt that it was worth doing it and that they certainly could not do it secretly, because it would come out, as these things always do, and then they would look really bad for having done it in secret. So, anyway, a little bit troubling. But
I'm glad that they at least had the sense to publish it, but you're right. I mean, that's not... It's better than nothing. Hey, by the way, I noticed you're wearing the hacker shirt. I don't know. I have a no cup now, so...
So it just says N-O period?
Yeah, look, see? Oh, can you see cool. it? Oh, you don't. That's right. It just says N-O period. It's from the same people, Think Geek. Actually, a couple of guys from the Argonne National Labs in Illinois came by, Tom and Steve, and they brought me this no mug, obviously, Security Now listeners. So thank you, Tom and Steve. Now, Steve and I both say no.
No. I ran across an interesting page that showed... this is in our errata topic, that showed the current demographic breakdown of web clients on the net by operating system. So not the traditional IE versus Firefox, but, you know, what percentage of Windows XP is on the net? And what I found interesting was that today XP has 84%.
What?
I'm sorry. No, sorry. 64% of the OS. Vista is at 23. Mac is at 5.12. Windows 7 at 3.77. Linux at 1%. Windows 2000 still out there, 0.62%, and the iPhone is 0.54%, with miscellaneous others at 1%. So summing up the various Windows, XP, Vista, Windows 7, and Windows 2000, Windows is at 91.26%, with Mac at 5, and then Linux at 1.
Wow.
So still very skewed toward Windows, but those numbers are certainly, you know, Windows numbers are falling, Mac is rising, Linux is rising, they certainly have a ways to go.
There's some, you know, problems, as you can imagine, with the particular methodology and how the browsers identify themselves, but I think in general that's the correct proportion.
Yeah. And an interesting report that was sent back from the future by Jake and Philip, who need to remain anonymous, they explain, because they're with the time correction team. The subject of the email that caught my eye was SpinRite Saves the Future. And they write, "Dear Steve, my team and I would like to express our heartfelt appreciation for SpinRite, your fine, life-saving product. We've all become tremendous fans of SpinRite 12. Of course, I'm only
12. Six. Wait a minute, you're up to 6.
Yeah, I'm at SpinRite 6. So, and given
these people are calling from Alderaan. Okay, that's fine. I understand.
Essentially, yes. Given the fact that I release major version updates very infrequently,
12 is going to be
12 is out there a ways. Yeah. So they continue. "Your software saved our lives. Here's what happened. My team was sent on a mission to prevent some unfortunate results of the bad science presented in the movie 2012.
Oh, boy.
While traveling too close to the sun, an unexpected solar flare..." And I was thinking, okay, are there any expected solar flares? But, you know, I guess if you're a time traveler, you
know.
Have.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, exactly. So one caught them by surprise. "An unexpected solar flare hit our craft, resulting in a near-complete loss of data from every system on board. This caused our re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere to be very far off course. At this time, I would like to apologize to the people of Utah. I cannot imagine the fright our re-entry must have given everyone there. Please accept our sincere apology. Anyway, once we landed, if you may call it that, we set about restoring our data. We popped in SpinRite version 12, and in a mere 3 days' time, all of the data from our craft was back, exactly as it had been prior to the above-mentioned unpleasantness. Now, this does give me pause, Lee, to think that maybe spinning magnetic hard drives are not as short-lived as I was
they
concerned.
They might survive.
Yeah, apparently SSDs didn't take over the future.
You'll invent some way to save SSDs.
But he doesn't specify what kind of technology SpinRite version 12 has recovered. So he says, you really saved our pork product, parens bacon, as they say in your time. Steve, you really are a magician. And although we really shouldn't tell you this, CryptoLink version 3 is going to rock the world.
I love it.
Please keep up your good work. Sincerely, Time Correction Team XVI.
I love it. Somebody reads a little too much science fiction.
Hey, they have to read a lot to keep up with me. So
I'm reading the new recording of Jerry Pournelle's Moat in God's Eye, which Audible just released.
One of my favorite, all-time favorite books.
I love the genre, you know, first contact genre. You know what? I've never read this one before, which is funny.
What? You've never read the Moat?
Is that weird? No.
Oh, Leo, it's got a surprise. It's such a good surprise.
Well, I love Larry Niven, so.
Yes, and when Niven and Pournelle get together, it's great. That's the only problem with that book is that you don't know something which you will never forget once you learn it.
I love it.
And it makes it a little more difficult to reread it. And I'm a big book rereader.
Oh, well, I'm lucky then. I've never read it, so I'm in heaven here.
Go slow. Don't read it overnight. Because
well, that's what's nice
like,
about
oh,
Audible. No, that's what's nice about Audible. You really kind of can relish it. But, you know, Jerry told me when he was on Twit a couple of weeks ago that the way they work together is Jerry is the plotter. He said, you know, I'm better at plotting than Larry is, and Larry's better at writing than I am. So Jerry does the plotting, and Niven does the writing for the
and
most part.
Fills in all of the plot specifics.
Right.
Interesting.
So you can credit Jerry Pournelle with the twist.
Good point.
I cannot wait. Anyway,
wait till you learn the secret.
I'm not saying anything. But one of the things I really like about it, I was a big fan, still am a big fan of the Patrick O'Brien, 19th century seafaring novels. And what's funny is the future. And this takes place, I think, in the year 3000. The Navy, the spacers are like the Navy. It's exactly the same kind of thing. They have stewards who bring. It's just like they're at sea. And obviously, that was an intentional parallel done by Larry and Jerry. And I think it works so well. It's really, really great. So anyway, I don't know why I mentioned that, but I'm reading that right now. Hey, we're going to get to our questions. We've got some great ones for you. Including, at the very end, of course, we say the good stuff, the brilliant Disneyland authentication solution of the week. I've been hearing from a lot of Disneyland folks about this system, by the way.
Yep, I have too. There was a surprising number of Disney notes in the last mailbag.
Yeah.
So
a lot of Disney folks listen to us. All right, Steve, are you ready for a question or two?
Ready, yeah.
Ready, Eddie. Question one from Chris in Las Vegas, Nevada. He's thinking about ARP.
ARP.
Steve, Windows throws an error when it receives an ARP response for the same... Okay, here we go. Get ready. Buckle in. Windows throws an error when it receives an ARP response from an IP address it's trying to use itself, saying another device has the same IP on the LAN. We've all seen this. If you use static IP addresses, for instance, it'll say, well, there's another... another device in the LAN with the same IP address. So wouldn't it be trivial to have the stack throw an error if it received multiple responses for the same IP address from different MAC addresses? We're trying to avoid ARP spoofing here. It could also just be a small program running that watches for such anomalies and notifies the user. It should always be, if it's one IP address, the same MAC address. The only real downside I can see is in cases of sites using something like link aggregation or something or bonding.
In that case, you might get a false positive. What do you think? That's an interesting idea.
Well, it's a great idea, and I think I mentioned a couple weeks ago that one of the things I was going to toss into CryptoLink, because it's so easy to do, exactly as Chris says, is just watch the LAN traffic for anything suspicious. And so, for example, another example of something suspicious would be if an IP to MAC address mapping appears to change. Now, that would happen if you deliberately manually change the IP address on some machine on your network. But that's normally not happening. So, but it would be an indication of someone coming in and beginning to spoof ARP traffic and mess up the IP to MAC address mapping. So Chris is completely right. It would be it's a trivial thing to do, a simple little program. You know, it's not, for example, in Windows, mostly because people wouldn't know what to do with it. It had the idea of an IP address collision had to be in Windows. And as you say, Leah, we've all seen this. It's in Windows and Mac and Linux and, right, you know, Unix, all the OSs, where they detect more than they detect some other device that is responding to a MAC address query for the same IP that they have. And it's like, wait a minute. And again, it's all these OSs detect it and alert the user, because you cannot have, just by definition, two devices with the same IP address on the same LAN. That would just cause confusion. Technically, electrically, it's possible, but we're going to disallow that, because, you know, who is supposed to be the recipient of the traffic? So in typical sort of Microsoft approach, how would you present a warning to the user saying, oh, we believe that ARP spoofing may be occurring on your network? It's like, okay, well, you're never going to see a note like that from Microsoft. So it makes sense for it to be an add-on utility or something that an expert user would know how to interpret. And another example would be if this utility were to remember the MAC address of the gateway persistently. So that is, like, you know, make a little entry in the registry and then notify you if at any time in the future the MAC address for the gateway appears to change. Because that's classic man-in-the-middle ARP spoofing, where somebody else, you know, spoofs the gateway ARP response in order to get themselves knitted in the middle. Well, I mean, I'd love to know if, without me doing anything, the MAC address for my gateway changes, because there's absolutely no reason it ever should. Or if I get the notice after just having reconfigured my network, I go, oh, yeah, of course, right, I just made a change. That I'm expecting that. But, you know, so Chris is absolutely right. We will see that in CryptoLink. Maybe I'll spin out a little, you know, freebie that does that just while I'm at it, because it would be simple to do and makes a lot of sense.
And some routers, I'm being told by people in our chat room, do this and that kind of thing, and they warn about that kind of thing. So it's...
I've never seen that.
Moss Waltberg saying Cisco and HP switches have built-in ARP spoofing protection. I don't know if they use that technique for it.
Okay, yeah, that would be a different approach where they would be resistant. For example, one of the games that people have played historically is, it used to be that in the old trusting days of the Internet, a switch or router or anything actually building an ARP table that maps IPs to MAC addresses, they would simply accept as the truth any ARP response that they saw on the wire. You know, ARP traffic is broadcasted, and network address or network interface cards see all the traffic, even if they don't accept it all. In the case of they're on, for example, on a hub, as we used to use in the old days. And so it's possible for a third party on the network to see other devices getting themselves registered on the net using ARP and just say, oh, I might as well add that information to my own local ARP table in case I ever need to talk to any of those guys. I already know their MAC address, so I don't have to go ask them, you know, go through the whole ARP protocol broadcast and response to get that. In other words, they used to just accept all the traffic on the network and store it. Well, that's absolutely wide open for exploitation because it means that spoofing is trivial.
Right.
All you do is you just send out malicious ARP packets and everybody on the network will accept them as gospel. And so one of the things, you know, so there are many things you can do. For example, you would never accept an ARP reply unless you were expecting one. That is only when you had a pending request out and were expecting a reply would you take it. And in any kind of a race condition, you could do things like if you got two different replies, you could say, ah, I think I'm going to stay with who I believe from the previous response rather than some newcomer that's different. So you could certainly see plenty of strategies for putting filters up and preventing this kind of stuff from being just so wide open.
Right. Question two, Peter Jaros from Brooklyn, New York. He has a new approach to defeating whole disk encryption and other in-memory key schemes. We talked a little bit about that. Never unplug the machine. Steal the computer without ever turning off the power or let the machine go to sleep. How would you do that? He actually gives us a link to Wiebetech, WIEBETECH.com, and I'm guessing it's some sort of battery backup. Yeah, it says transport a live computer without shutting it down. No other product performs this patent pending feat. It's a hot plug device, obviously just a battery, big old battery you plug the computer into and then take it with you. And by the way, it says right here, how to circumvent whole disk encryption.
Okay, so it actually is more clever than that.
Oh, really?
It's very cool.
Wiebetech, if you want to see this, .com.
Okay, so the computer's plugged in. Okay, well, so you can't ever power it down, yet it's receiving power now.
Right.
So this clever thing is able to run in parallel with existing power.
Oh, it would have to be, yeah. So this would be for, like, law enforcement. They come into your house. They think something's going on in your computer. It's running, and you logged in. So whole disk encryption is now – everything's unlocked, but they obviously can't reboot or they'll never get into it. So somehow they have to keep it exactly powered up and take it back to the station.
They also need to keep the screensaver from activating.
Oh boy.
Or the machine going into standby. So they have a little USB dongle called the mouse wiggler. And it says it just generates little mouse move messages.
I love it.
So they plug this thing into a USB port, and the mouse starts jiggling around on the screen. Now, the reason that caught my eye is that I was asked a couple years ago to be part of an advisory panel for an FBI effort to build a lab on the West Coast. They wanted to do a big forensics lab, and they wanted it to have all the stuff it needed. And in some of the meetings that I attended, they were explaining here are the problems that we have. And one of the problems that they really do have is, you know, they get a warrant for some company's hardware that, you know, computers that they believe there's bad stuff on. And, you know, if they turn the computers off, there's active encryption on the system, they can't get back in. And so this is really a problem that they have. So this gadget, not only does it have the little USB mouse wiggler, but it's like a UPS, but it's one where the power comes out of the AC outlet. So they give two examples. One is where they say, well, you know, many computers are plugged into an outlet strip.
Right.
So you plug this backup power supply in, with a male plug, you plug it into the power strip along with the computer.
So this is kind of a feature of power strip. It's all, I guess, it's in serial, and you can just apply power to any plug socket.
Sure, they're all the power strip connectors are just in parallel. So you plug it into the power strip.
Okay.
You plug it into the power strip, then you unplug the power strip from the wall.
Right, because it's now getting power.
It is now, exactly. So the power is feeding into one connector of the power strip as power to the computer. Or if the computer is plugged directly into the wall, and on their site they show a little picture of this, you, if there's anything else, all wall outlets have like two plugs. So you unplug the lamp or whatever is plugged in there with it. You plug their box into the other dual outlet. Then unscrew it, pull it out, and snip the wires.
Wow.
So now you've got their backup unit running, just routed through this little two-outlet plug back to the computer.
They call this their outlet seizure method.
And I just think it's very clever. It's, they've got the mouse wiggler to keep the machine alive. And
should have to have a license to buy this stuff. I mean, really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's diabolical, and it would prevent you from, basically they don't know if the computer shuts down that they're going to lose all access to it, but they do know that it's alive and running now.
Why take a chance? I can see the stuff now, so let's snag it.
Yep. I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's a large order from the FBI coming their way.
Oh yeah.
I do know that the FBI, from our conversations, I mean, this is a problem that they've got, and this would solve it. Yeah. I just thought it was very clever. I knew our listeners would get a kick out of it.
Oh, I love it. Weebitech. They have the videos just demonstrating the whole thing on the site. I was just looking at them. Pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it actually works.
Let's move on. Question number 3 from Tom Eoflin. Tom Eoflin. From Karlstad, Sweden. He has a password manager for my mom. Actually, it wasn't my mom that had the problem, but we'll use it.
A generic mom.
Hi, Steve. Leo mentioned a couple of Security Now episodes ago he didn't think his mom would use any of the password managers out there, but there is one that is just as simple as Notepad. All right, I don't think anybody can figure that out. Secure. The application is called LockNote. It's made by Steganos. It's a text editor / notepad and encrypted text document in one. Wow. It's a portable application. No need for installation. You can run it right off a USB stick. It's only 312 kilobytes in size. And since you only store text in it, it's not going to grow that much, even with tons of passwords in it. It is open source. It's on SourceForge for the paranoid. You can get it from Steganos. STEGANOS.com. It says you cannot have multiple documents in one instance of LockNote, but you can easily copy the application and have multiple versions with different passwords if you want. Simple application like this probably can run in multiple instances on Windows. Just a thought as I pass this along, I've used this in combination with Super GenPass, which I've recommended, for a long time now. I even have a LockNote version for gift ideas to my friends. So it doesn't have to just be passwords. You can lock up anything in here. You have mentioned on the show that when someone passes away, it can be hard to end that person's accounts on all the sites he or she may have been registered on. Well, an envelope with your LockNote password and the location of the file solves that. Put that in a security safe deposit box or something. He says, I'm no way affiliated with the makers of LockNote, just a fan. Love the podcast. You should make it twice a week. Tom in Sweden, what do you think? Have you looked at it?
I have, and the reason I posted this was I'm impressed.
It's a good idea.
I've got the source, and I'm going to take a look at it because they don't talk at all about what they're doing, and I want to make sure that what they're doing makes sense. But what this is just an EXE. When you download it, and if you go to Steganos, STEGANOS.com, it took me a little while to find it, but on the left-hand column under free stuff, there's like 4 free things. The other ones aren't very compelling, but this one was called LockNote. You just download it, and that's it. It's There's no setup. There's no install. I mean, I like everything about this so far. It's just like a notepad app. In fact, it looks exactly like the Windows notepad. And what's cool is that you can cut and copy and paste, and it acts in every way like notepad. Then you can assign a password to it. Now, as far as I could tell, it makes no attempt to make sure you use a good password. I just put nuts in, N-U-T-S, and it loved it. So it's like, okay, well, that's not a super good password. I could have probably put R in, and it would have been happy. But what's nice is that it binds the text and the password into itself, into the XE. So you never have a separate separate text file. It's just this XE. And as he says, I mean, I'm a little thinking, okay, 312K, that's huge. But, you know, that's just my bias because, you know, if it were an assembler, it'd be much smaller. But it's neat because you then, under the file menu, you can change the password. And the only way you can change the password is if you know the password, because if you try to run it when there is a password, it just says, what's the password? And so, I mean, it's very clean. It for me, I know, as I mentioned before, I just got this one big list of URLs and usernames and passwords that I keep in my Palm Pilot. Well, I could easily just cut and copy and paste that into this, give it a really good, strong password, because the vulnerability would be, you know, guessing the password. So you want to make sure that it's not guessable. I love it because it is so clean. It is so simple. There's nothing to learn, no UI, no fanciness. It's not trying to do more than just locking up a text file, which it and the password are in some fashion bundled to itself. Now, again, these guys clearly know security. They've got a bunch of security stuff on their site. So I'm assuming they're doing everything correct with the password. That is, they're not including the password in the XE. Instead, they're hashing the password or encrypting it or doing something. Anyway, I've got the source. Well, here's a perfect example. We were talking at the top of the show why open source can be useful. Frankly, if they told me on their site, this is exactly what we're doing, yeah, I believe that, because they've disclosed it and they have no reason to lie to me. But they didn't tell me anything about what they're doing. So the good news is I can answer those questions by looking at the source.
You can validate it, yeah.
Yeah, so I will. Well, there's nothing to validate because they didn't say anything.
Right.
But I want to know that for myself what they're doing, and I will next week tell all of our listeners exactly what they're doing from my having looked at the source and be able to say, okay, here's exactly what they're doing, and they did it all right. So anyway, it's very cool. I wanted to tell our Windows users. Unfortunately, there's no Mac version, although it's open source. Again, it's not a super brilliant, hard to reproduce concept, but it's just done, and it's very nice. I like how clean it is, and it's a cool little gizmo.
Very, very neat. Question four, a long one. Get ready. Stand back. Jim in California in the Bay Area has some real-world feedback about what? Web of Trust. We talked about that, I think, a couple episodes ago.
Yep, a browser add-on.
Steve, first of all, let me say I've been a fan of yours for many years. The security information you post on GRC.com is invaluable. I've been a regular user of Shields Up for years. I'm also a very happy owner of SpinRite, which is an essential tool for my computer work. It's fantastic. Now, I recently discovered Security Now. Wow. I had no idea you were on the air, and I'm thrilled. Now I'm listening nearly nonstop to previous and weekly podcasts and passing it on to my other geek friends. This is a big thing for me, is I don't understand how people could be in the tech industry and not know that Twit exists, but they do. They are. It's people like you and Leo that really make the world a better place, as your help to others is priceless. Thank you. Spread the word. Let them know. What I'm writing to you about is a point regarding Web of Trust. There's a bad shortcoming regarding Watt. I started using it and recommending it about a year or more ago, so he was ahead of us on this one.
What I found was that undeserving sites were being blacklisted, that is, approved in WAT. These sites were listed as having malware, adult content, etc. Oh, I'm sorry. Blacklisted means bad. They're bad. Okay.
Right.
So they're undeserving sites that are fine were listed as being not so fine. I knew nothing could be further from the truth. These sites were totally safe and helpful. On emailing Watt about this, I was informed that Watt does not moderate the ratings. How it works is when a user finds what he or she believes to be a bad site, they simply tag it as bad. What category of problem occurred in comments? Yeah. That's a problem in a lot of things, email black holing with maps and orbs and that kind of thing.
Yep.
There's no appeal process. There needs to be some way of aggregating the information and kind of validating it. Seems some users may think they got infected from a certain site, but due to the nature of clickjacking or maybe cross-site scripting, it may not have been from that site at all, possibly not even during that session. We all know that. Users often don't know what happened or why. Further, when some internet griefers, what some internet griefers are doing is using it to launch political or social or other attacks on websites by using Watt to blacklist that site. Any user who uses Watt will see a warning page when they attempt to go to the actually benign site. This warning is a full page and will certainly scare off any new visitors. Better safe than sorry. Consequently, as you might imagine, I've stopped using Watt and stopped advising its use to others as it forwards malicious users' efforts to deny service to legitimate websites. That's a shame. Web of Trust is a neat idea, but unfortunately, it really needs trust, or at least modifiers and verifiers. An expensive proposition. Perhaps Watt has corrected this problem in some way. It's been over a year since I conversed with them. As always, there are people in the world who use technology to harm rather than help. They need to follow the examples of Steve and Leah. That's a shame, but that's a very good point.
And it's not surprising. I mean, the concern was that their threshold for blacklisting a site would be very low. And you could argue that if they don't have a huge user base, then they're not going to have an opportunity to receive a large consensus on a site being bad. In fact, it sounds to me like, you know, any user saying, oh, I got hurt by this site, suddenly makes it questionable.
Right.
Now, it'd be nice if they, like, published how many people agreed or if there was, you know.
That's what they need. They
disagree.
Need some aggregation or something, yeah.
Yeah, but he's right. As it is now, it sounds like they're, you know, it's just, unfortunately, he's right that it would cost a huge amount of money for them to go around verifying everything, which, frankly, when we were discussing this, I was saying that I liked the idea that Google's bots were doing this because, you know, they've got no cross to bear. They're looking at all the code. They're able to be kept up to date with the latest exploits and see whether they see evidence of those exploits on the sites that the bots visit
right.
in their normal, you know, web visiting that as they spider around the web. So, yeah, to me, I think that does make more sense than this kind of an aggregation approach.
Alas, it's true.
Yep.
Matthew Justice in Austin, Texas, a good place for justice, wonders about Google DNS server. Steve, just in case you did not see this, is actually we happened since we talked last. This is brand new.
Yes.
Google is now doing its open DNS kind of a thing. It's a public DNS server, 8.8.8.8. He says, you might want to run it through your new DNS benchmark tool, and when might be the world be able to play with this? Love your show. Thank you, Matthew. So you have a tester. When this bind flaw was first publicized, you figured out a way to test, right?
Well, actually, it's different than that.
Oh, okay.
If it'll pop your eyes out of your head, Leo, but if you go to grc.com/DNS/benchmark.htm.
Okay.
You'll see just a screenshot of it, and it's this is what I spent a large chunk of the year working on. It's gorgeous, and I just need to finish its documentation.
Well, let's see it. We want it.
We'll have it soon. So many people wrote about Google's new DNS service.
So this just tests the speed, not its security. That's right.
True.
We showed another program that tested the security.
The spoofability system is tied to this. And, in fact, I got onto this because I wanted to launch them both around the same time. So this is performance as opposed to security.
This is great.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
Steve, wow.
It's a real piece of work.
Now, you can't download it yet, or can you?
No, it's there. It's downloadable. Just click on it, and it's tiny.
175K. I downloaded it faster than my mouse could click it, practically.
Yeah, and it's all assembler, and, you know, it works. I'm glad that Google did this, because I'll add Google's servers to it. I've seen a couple postings from people who have used it already, and Google's benchmarking a little slower than OpenDNS. And this thing even tells you if like OpenDNS is in its default configuration, if it redirects mistakes.
Google
does not do that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
which surprised me, because if anybody would want to stick some advertising in there, I would have thought it would be Google.
And do you know, I've been so preoccupied trying to get this, you know, get ready to get this finished, that I have not yet looked in depth at Google's DNS offering. Have you done a show on it yet?
Yeah, we talked about it on This Week in Google, and I have certainly used it.
What's Google's motivation?
Well, you know, they don't disclose their motivation. They say, well, we just, you know, we want to improve the net experience on the net, because the more you use, and actually this is probably true, the more you use the net, the more, the happier we are, right? And that makes sense. Now, the problem is there is OpenDNS already, and frankly, OpenDNS, I think, has some significantly better features, things like filtering and so forth, but, you know, the nice thing about Google, it's easy to remember, it's 8.8.8.8, and I can't remember what the other one was.
The other one is 8.8.4.4.
So very simple, very easy to remember. You know, I think it's good to have another one out there. I can't see anything wrong with it.
Yeah, well, we'll know soon how its performance compares, and ultimately, I think that's the way it will win, with a tool like this that makes it easy for you to see how, from your location, what is the fastest server, which is really what you want to know. That's why I just, you know, no one can say, oh, OpenDNS is faster. Well, you might live next door to Google's DNS server, in which case it's going to be a lot faster.
Right. So I'm adding 8.8.8.8, and so how I just would click to run it, or how would run benchmark. Okay. Oh, I have to right-click it? I'm not too bright when it comes to this. I see the red button. Now what do I do?
You can click on the big GRCG logo if you want. That'll start it up.
Oh, okay. Well, it's testing them all now. I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right, cool. So, yeah, Google is sinking to the bottom at this point. So,
yeah, and it may be that they've said, okay, we're launching this, and over time we're going to install more servers.
It's got plenty of bandwidth, right?
Yeah, we can imagine if they wanted to give OpenDNS a run for their money, they'd be able to.
You know, Verizon's is very fast, the 4.0.
Yes.
Yeah, Google's way down on the list. Not way, way, way down, but lower than some of the other ones. Interesting. So this continues to run.
Until it finishes. You'll see a little progress bar there at the top, which is moving along.
Yeah, oh, that's neat.
And it shows cached, uncached, and .com. Those three different bars are showing you different things. And then if any little red marks appear on the left, that's reliability problems, because it's looking for any loss of reliability. There's a ton of technology here. It's what I've been working on. I've talked about it a number of times.
That's neat.
And we'll do a show on benchmarking DNS as soon as I get all the documentation finished.
I see in the chat room. Leo, you might want to click the giant run benchmark button. I'm not that bright. Sorry. Let's move on. Question. So, yeah, I mean, I think this is a good choice. I use OpenDNS. Now, OpenDNS does do the thing that you may not like and others may not like, which is if you do a bogus, a non-existent search, it pops up a helpful page with some advertising on it that says, you know, did you mean this? Bother me.
Other people are beginning to do it, too. Other ISPs, Comcast, I believe, is doing that. You'll see that you'll see that OpenDNS is shown in orange in the benchmark. I detect that for any DNS server. And so I alert people that this is what's going on. And on the summary page, once the benchmark is finished, I actually interpret everything that has happened and compare your DNS servers that you currently are using to everything we just learned about all the other alternatives and advise whether there's, I actually compute whether there's a statistical statistically significant improvement that you could make by making some changes. So, anyway,
top four on my results are orange, and numbers 2 and 3 are OpenDNS, which is usually what I use. I like OpenDNS because I can say I can use the filtering in my for my kids and stuff.
Well,
like that.
And if you become a subscriber, you can turn off the redirection.
Right.
So it's not like you're
free.
Yeah,
it's not like you have to pay for anything.
Yeah,
I use the redirection because first of all, I like it, and I don't want to. I want to support them.
Yes,
it's all for free. Question 6 comes from Lex Thomas in Research Triangle Park, beautiful North Carolina. He wonders about router DNS. It's a little different. I've been reading about Google's new free DNS project. We just talked about that a few years ago. For a brief time, I used OpenDNS, liked it a lot, but after an unfortunate and unrelated incident, I had to restore my PC, which caused me to lose my OpenDNS settings. I put mine in the router. I think that's what he's about to say.
Huh.
After that, I just never got around to putting OpenDNS back in. I just defaulted to using what the ISP sent down the pipe. I suppose I should have set up my router instead to point to OpenDNS rather than doing it in Windows. Since I'd probably want every computer on the network to use this alternate DNS anyway. I haven't made up my mind about Google's DNS yet. But are there any advantages or disadvantages to using the DNS lookup in the router as opposed to the operating system? Thanks for a great show. Been a fan for years. Yeah, I've been using it I use it in my router at home because that way my kids, you know, unless they're smart enough to bypass it, are motivated to bypass it, which apparently they're not at this point. You know, any computer they use, it has the same filtering on it.
Well, we've learned some interesting things not only through the work on the DNS benchmark, we meaning myself and all the people in the GRC.DNS news group, where we've had, you know, actively been working on this and on the spoofability tester before.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is that there's a growing list of routers that the spoofability test crashes. And it's, as we know, exploits start out as crashes, and then people figure out exactly what it was and how that the router is crashing, and they turn them into remote code execution. And so there's the possibility that there are a surprising number of routers that you can give them a specially formed DNS response and take over the router. So we're a little concerned about that. So I discussed that on the spoofability system pages. The other concern I have is that typical consumer routers are not very smart. You know, they're made to be very inexpensive so that they're profitable for the people making them. And doing DNS lookup correctly is sort of tricky. You want to remember what the fastest configured DNS server is, and you want to give it a chance to reply. But if it doesn't reply, then you want to ask it again, and if it still doesn't, then you want to ask all your second and, you know, secondary, tertiary, and so forth servers. And the fact is, you know, this is the logic that Unix and Mac and Windows uses. That is, when all these OSs are given multiple DNS servers, they use them intelligently and in a way that overall maximizes performance. The problem is that if you remoted your DNS to the router, now it's sort of your proxy. And so your computers all just get one DNS address, meaning the router, and are at the mercy of the router doing the right thing. It's certainly possible for a smart router to be doing, you know, a good job with DNS resolution and be passing that back to the clients that are using it to provide that service. But the fact that we've seen flaky router operation and in fact the DNS benchmark has revealed that some routers are much slower than going direct. That is, the router is actually a speed problem for that. And so, for example, you give you use in the benchmark, you leave the router registered, and you'll end up finding that, for example, going directly to OpenDNS is faster than using your, you know, like often 192.168.0.1, for example, because typically your DNS will be the same as your gateway, which is the IP that the router has inside your network. So we've also seen, thanks to this benchmark, that using the router is slower than manually configuring DNS and just bypassing it completely. So, you know, your mileage may vary. Once the benchmark is finished and public, people will be able to see for themselves. Certainly, Lex is right. Putting those settings, sort of making them global for your whole network, exactly as you've done at home, Leo, can make sense, because then every system gets the benefit of, you know, making a single configuration change.
Right. And you can override it, because if you override the DNS numbers in any individual machine, it'll override it. And so,
exactly. Yeah. Instead of just saying obtain DNS automatically, right, you just manually put those in.
And don't tell my kids that.
Exactly. Right.
Well, actually, what I do is I lock down the settings and the administrator password to change the network settings. So it's actually so much more effective, I think, than any filtering solution out there. It just seems like that's the no-brainer for any parent.
Yep. So switch to OpenDNS and then go to your OpenDNS configuration page,
right,
and remove the kinds of sites that you don't want.
Well, it has built in. You can just say, you know, I mean, it has a whole list, but it has pretty good filtering. You can say, you know, just keep this safe. And but you have to create an account. It's free, though. That's the advantage.
Yeah.
Steve, are you ready for our Disney authentication questions of the week? Starting with question 7, Daniel Ernst from West Bloomfield, Michigan, U.S. of A. His Disney fingerprint story. I'm a week behind. Just finished 224. Thought I'd mention my experience with fingerprints at Disney. My family went to the Disney parks in Florida last year and encountered the fingerprint scanners. I've been guarding my fingerprints for as long as I can remember, going back to an FBI tour in the 70s. That's neat. He wised up in the 70s and not volunteering to have my fingerprints taken. I'm sure I would have balked at giving them up at Disney had I been surprised by it, but being a Security Now listener, I was well prepared. I didn't even try the knuckle thing. I waved over a gatekeeper and explained I'm a privacy advocate. This is what people should do.
Yes.
Instead of trying to fake it, let them know. Because if enough people complain, they go, oh, I guess we can't use this system. I waved over a gatekeeper, explained I'm a privacy advocate. Nice way to put it. I'm sure he did this nicely. Refused to give up my family's fingerprints. This is interesting. The employee wasn't surprised. Told us the alternative is to show photo ID each time we use our passes. We had our IDs out the next few days at the entry gates, and without a hiccup, we were let in each time almost as quickly as those giving their fingers. So no need to fool them. Let them know you'll take the alternative. If enough people do, maybe they'll get the message. That's great. I love
it.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really good bit of news. I did a bunch of people, as you know, as you apparently independently experienced, Leo, have been talking about this and Disney. And I found an article that talked about Disney's policy where they say that they are deliberately keeping this biometric data separate, that they're not recording a fingerprint at the resolution that is enough data points so that it could even be used for recognition. It could only be used as a go, no-go sort of verification. So only a few aspects of the fingerprint are being maintained, and they flush them after the pass, which is associated with it, has been expired by more than a month or something like that. So even independent of all this, it does sound like Disney, at least, was always conscious of these issues, which is really nice to hear. Of course, that doesn't tell us anything about anybody else's fingerprint policy. So everything we've said about, you know, banks needing you to use your fingerprint in order to cash a check and so forth likely still applies. But at least in the case of Disney, it sounds like they've been acting responsibly.
Yeah. And here we go with our brilliant Disneyland authentication solution of the week, and this comes from another Swede. You know, we have a lot of Swedish listeners, and just a tip of the hat, it's really great to have all these listeners all over the world. I love it. And Tom Afloen from Karlstad, Sweden, says, "Hi, Steve. You and Leo sometimes talk about the problem with companies wanting to have your fingerprint. I think it's going to be harder and harder to resist this. By the way, if you are a Swedish citizen, you come to the U.S., you get fingerprinted, and you sometimes get iris scanned as well. And with nagging kids behind you, and a stubborn Disneyland employee in front of you, the slightest obvious knuckle solution might not always work. So why not dedicate a finger? Save your index fingers for personal use. Use your pinkies as a personal backup in case you injure your index fingers. Let's say use, I don't know, what's left, your middle finger for external companies. I can't wait until I can hold up my middle finger, my palm facing me at the Disneyland reader, and pressing it down there. There's no correlation between the fingerprints on your different fingers, right? I mean, if they have my middle finger, it doesn't mean they can figure out what my index finger is. Love the show, Tom in Sweden. What a great... does that mean the same thing in Sweden as it means in the U.S.? I don't know.
Apparently it does. So. And I just... but I loved the idea. I don't know why. I mean, it's so simple. You know, yeah. we've got 10.
We've got 10.
And he's right. There's no correlation of fingerprints from one to the other. So if it's not like your DNA where they can say, oh, look, this is the father of somebody because they're able to see that it's a close match. And so... by all means, you know, if, you know, use your middle finger for the bank that insists that you know, they have a fingerprint and you may need to conceal which finger you're using. But if you can get away with it, I think that makes a lot of sense. I thought that was very simple and very clever. You know, some of the good ideas are.
God, man, you're brilliant. You're brilliant. Now, I've completed the benchmark here from the DNS benchmark and... yeah, the Google, I see a level 3 is very high up there. Google is, you know, fairly far down, not at the bottom of the list, in the top 20. But by far, OpenDNS is the fastest. I don't know what this 156, 154, 70.
You can click one of the tabs. The other tabs will identify by name.
Neustar. I don't know who Neustar.
And they're like pretty high on your list?
They're number one on my list.
Ah, interesting.
Look at that. Incredible response. Only their cache time is almost zero. Their purple bar.
Interesting. So it must be. See, that's one of the things that's so interesting about this is, you know, DNS performance is absolutely a function of where you are.
Right.
So it must be that if you're using your fancy Ethernet T1 or no super connection, that for whatever reason, wherever that terminates is got, you know, very short response time to that particular server.
Here's an interesting tidbit. The highest ranked DNS server that does not replace, you know, the 404 page is NTT. That's the Japanese telecom. No, I think it's NTT Docomo, isn't it? America Technical Operations. Then Speakeasy, Neustar again, then Level 3. Somebody's saying in the chat room that Google uses Level 3, so their connectivity might be coming through Level 3. Then Sprint. Speakeasy is very big on there. The Planet. Time Warner. It's interesting. So Comcast, Verizon, and then Google way down on that list.
It's a cool little app, isn't
it? Oh, I love this. Steve, I wish more people knew about this.
Everyone will know as soon as I get the documentation finished.
Plug this more. Oh, wait a minute. I'm seeing Google. It's announcing itself. It is above some of those others as at level 3 communications, not as Google 8.8.8.8. So I wonder if they're just using level 3's DNS server and branding it Google.
And click on the recommendations. Is that what it is? No. Conclusions.
Conclusions.
And it turns everything into English so that people who aren't super gurus can just sort of quickly scan through, and it highlights important things that it found.
It's interesting because we're using, it says there's only one DNS in here, and it's our local router's DNS.
So it knows that, right?
Yeah. But I think that's because this is Skypeosaurus, which with DNS is not important to Skypeosaurus particularly. System name server is slower than 3 public alternatives. This is great. Look at this, Steve. You're brilliant.
Well, this is a big piece of work, but
can't believe this. And this is free.
Yeah.
grc.com/DNS/benchmark. You can get it right now. It's a tiny download. You'll think you didn't really get it. When you click on it, it's like, wait a minute, I must have missed that. So like 5 copies. Because it was so fast. Steve writes everything in assembly. This is what's so great about Steve. Look, if you go to grc.com, buy SpinRite just to say thank you, Steve. And by the way, it's a great thing to have. Everybody who has hard drives needs SpinRite. It's the world's best hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. But there's so much great free stuff there, like this benchmarker. And And, of course, the show is there, including 16-kilobit versions. Steve makes those himself. We stopped making them, so Steve said, nope, going to make them, going to have them. Thank you, Steve. He also does pays for transcriptions himself. He takes his stuff really seriously, so give him your support because he works very hard for us. GRC.com. Do you know what we're doing next week? Maybe we're answering that question about ARP spoofing and random data. I don't know.
We're definitely. I'm gonna come clean and say that I got myself tangled up on the last Q&A and I'll have a complete, thorough, clear answer.
Good. And all the security news and more every week with Steve right here. You can watch us do the show live on Wednesdays. We do it at 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific. Every Wednesday, unless there's a schedule change, but you'll find the schedule in our calendar and the live video at live, L-I-V-E dot twit, T-W-I-T dot TV. And some really interesting changes coming to our websites soon that's going to make it easier for you to see what you want, including video of all our shows and this one as well. So people who have been wanting to see Steve's smiling face as he saves the world can do that. It's all at twit.tv and live.twit.tv for the live streaming. Steve, we'll see you next week. Have a great week.
Thanks, Leo. You too.